Okay, let's get started. Just a 1 30-second advertisement. If you are in Israel or you are planning on being in Israel at the end of the month, we are running first ever Torah in Motion Israel trip. We are going to be doing a 2-day, 2 1-day trips. You can join for one or both on Wednesday, the 28th of December and Thursday, the 29th. Wednesday the 28th, we're going to be in and around the Old City. Right? It's by foot, not on a bus, but we're going to be seeing new sites connected to Jerusalem, archaeology, history, a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, but seeing it in real life. And Thursday, we are doing a bus trip that is going to take us out to Gush Etzion, and also to the area of Beit Guvrin. And we're going to talk about the Bar Kokhba revolt. We're going to talk about Herodian and Herod, see the new excavations and the new technology in Herodian. It's really great. It's including a lunch and a winery stop, and it'll be very nice. So if you have any interest, if you're going to be here in the chat, there is a link to the page where you can register. I have it on good information from Rabbi Kalman that on Monday the prices will go up. So if you want to get the early bird discount, I am just quoting from him, now is the time to sign up. So I would love, love to see anybody who is around, and I will say this again at the very end. Yes, and anyone who wants to be in touch with me, you can email me and ask me any questions, and that is all. Okay, enough advertising. Let's get started. Okay, so after we've gone through three of the four quarters and we did an introduction, today we're going to venture outside the walls. Okay. And we're going to take a look. This is our fifth out of six classes. Next time we're going to talk about the Mount of Olives, which isn't in the Old City at all and technically isn't even really in the city. But today we're going to talk about what's going on outside the walls. Probably the most famous thing here is the neighborhood of Mishkenot Sha'ananim. And that's what we're going to be talking about, that first Jewish neighborhood outside the walls. But you may know, you may recognize the King David over here, right? The windmill, of course, from Mishkenot Sha'ananim. So our themes for today are like this. We're going to be talking about mostly about leaving the Old City and building the new neighborhoods outside the walls. But we're also going to talk about this area earlier and later, right? Earlier in terms of what do you have in the proximity of the city in ancient times, okay? You have graves, and we're going to see graves are right next door to the old city. People did not bury inside the city, but they buried close to it, okay? So we're going to see some ancient graves. This is a site that is also significant as the border between Israel and Jordan between 1948 and 1967. So we're going to address that a little bit. And we're also at the end going to take a little bit of a look at some of the grandiose building that happens here in the early 20th century before Israel becomes a state under the Ottoman Empire and under the British Mandate. Okay, so those are our basic outline of what we're going to be looking at today. Okay, so where are we? Let's just understand where we are. We are west of the Old City, right? So here's our outline of the Old City, right? I really wish I could draw straight. It would be so nice. Okay, sorry, not this over here. More or less. Okay, Zion Gate, right? Zion Gate, and we are to the west. So this nice green area here, we're going to talk about this. This is the area of Gay Ben Hinnom, the Hinnom Valley, okay? Zion Gate and Mount Zion are on the eastern side of the valley. We are going to be on the western side of the valley, okay? So here's the windmill. Here is the Begin Center. We're going to be talking about that, right? The King David and the YMCA. This is the area that we are going to be spending our time talking about. When we talk about graves, we're going to talk about right near the Begin Center. There's a site that's called Ketef Hinnom, Ketef as in shoulders, right? Ketefaim, the shoulders of the Hinnom Valley, meaning the slopes that are above the Hinnom Valley. And this is a place of burial. In fact, all of this area is a place of burial. We've also found burial caves right near the walls of the old city, right? Right near the walls of the old city over here. People buried outside the city, but not very far outside the city. Okay, so that's just for us to understand. We're going to start by taking a look at Gei Ben Hinnom, which we've looked at already in the first introductory class, but helpful to look at a little bit again. But then we're going to be taking ourselves to the western side of the valley and understanding what the sites are, but also important to notice, right? We said between 48 and 67, we're on the border, right? Obviously, the old city is in Jordanian hands. Zion Gate and Mount, well, not Zion Gate, but Mount Zion, as we mentioned in two times ago, right? We talked about how Mount Zion stays in Israeli hands, okay? But Gei Ben Hinnom, the Hinnom Valley is no man's land. Okay, dangerous, abandoned, not so safe to go from one to the other. And the neighborhoods on this side, right, the neighborhoods over here are kind of slummy, on the border, not so safe places. Anyone who's been to Jerusalem in the last 30 years knows that these are no longer slummy in any way. These are very, very high-end, fancy neighborhoods. But that only happens after the Six-Day War. Okay, so that's just a few different things we want to keep in mind as we go along. Okay, timeline, always helpful. This timeline is a little strange because we have a couple of things that are very early, and then we move zoom into the 19th century and the 20th century, but useful to have a sense. Okay, so the very end, the late First Temple period, 6th century before the Common Era, right before like the eve of the destruction of the First Temple, we have burial caves in Ketef Hinnom that we're going to be talking about. Very exciting, very important. Second Temple times, right? First century before the Common Era. The question mark is really in the wrong place. It should be after Herod. We have maybe a tomb that maybe was Herod's family, maybe not. We now know it definitely was not Herod's tomb because that's in Herodian, but maybe it's Herod's family. We'll talk about it, right? And the same time period, first century before the Common Era and on, we have aqueducts bringing water from the south, from the area of Gush Etzion, right, to the Temple Mount going through the Hinnom Valley. Okay, massive jump forward to the mid-19th century where everything starts to change in Jerusalem. You have more and more people. You have life expectancy grows, and people just are outgrowing the old city. The ones who are outgrowing the most are the Jews, and that's what we're going to be talking about. And 1857, we have the first attempt at kind of new housing in the old city, but this is inside the old city. This is called Batei Machsa. Not enough land, right? Not enough space. By 1858, the Russians, who are the first pioneers, Russian Christians, of course, they purchase land and they build a church and they build hostels for men and for women and they build a fancy hotel, and they are kind of the pioneers of moving outside the walls. But only a couple of years later, Moses Montefiore builds the first Jewish neighborhood outside the walls, Mishkenot Sha'ananim, right? We're going to talk a lot about that and about what else is built with his money, including what we call Yamin Moshe. Today, people kind of interchange Mishkenot Sha'ananim and Yamin Moshe, but they're actually two distinct neighborhoods. Okay. Another very important step forward for Jerusalem is 1892. We're coming up on 130-year anniversary. The train, the high-speed train. Today, we have a high-speed train from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. It really is a high-speed train. Anyone who's taken it is always is amazed, right? It takes about as long to get down on the escalators to the train platform as it takes to get to Tel Aviv. It's phenomenal. But here the high speed train was 4 hours long, but that was a very large improvement over the trip on the road, which was 16 hours long. So 1892, we have the train, which really makes Jerusalem much more central and important. Okay. By the time we get to the 1920s, the time of the British Mandate, we have another building spurt. The YMCA is built. 5 years later, the King David is built. And we're going to talk a little about the bombing of the King David, probably the most significant event that happens in the King David, in a place that has many significant events. December 1948, the city is divided, and we have a secret cable car. We'll get to that at the very end. between 48 and 67, Yamin Moshe is on the border. And in 67, the city is reunited and Yamin Moshe starts to become a very fancy neighborhood, which is a controversial story in and of itself, because in order to become a fancy neighborhood, you have to have fancy people. And in order to have fancy people, you have to get rid of the poor and, not so pleasant people who have been protecting the border for all those years. So that's a story in and of itself. But that's just to give us a sense of timing. Okay, let's just briefly look back at Gay Ben-Hinom, which we really did talk about, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. But we know Gay Ben-Hinom got shortened, the Gehenom, right? Gehenom comes from Gay Ben-Hinom. We said, why is such a nice valley? Why would you give it this terrible name? Okay. First of all, this is a very, very important valley. Okay. It encompasses the old city on the west and the south. So it protects the city on the west and the south, meets up in the south with the edge of the Kidron Valley. Okay, which protects the city in the east, so that the city is protected on three sides, just not on the north. So very significant, and you can see nice 19th century picture, people traveling through the valley. It's an important thoroughfare. It becomes a place, there's a market there. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But why is it Gehenna, right? So it's Gehenna because in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 19, Jeremiah talks about what people would do in the valley of Hinnom, in Gay Ben-Hinnom. What they would do is they would worship the Molech, right? This particular egregious and horrific idolatry, which involved some form of child sacrifice. And Jeremiah says, one day, lo yikare lamakom hazeh od tofet b'gei ben-hinom ki im gei ha-haregai. He says, the name is going to be changed from the valley of Ben-Hinnom, Mr. Ben-Hinnom's valley, to the valley of slaughter. But that's not what happened. What happened is that the name of hell was given the name of this valley, right? Not so fair to Mr. Ben-Hinnom, but what can you do? It's the way history goes. Down in the valley, we have a few very interesting things, okay? One of them is a cemetery over here on the right. This is a cemetery that's still being used, that has been in use since the Middle Ages, at least since the 13th century. It's a cemetery for the Karaite community. Okay, the Karaite community in Jerusalem is a community that's been around for a very long time. They claim they've been in Jerusalem since the 6th century. We don't have proof of that, but it seems pretty clear that they've been around certainly for 800-900 years in Jerusalem. And because they see themselves as separate from Jews and the Jews see themselves as separate from them, they have their own, they had their own cemetery, which is still being used today. So it's down in the Hinnom Valley. As you can see, it's not super taken care of, but it's in better shape than the cemetery that's next door, which we'll talk about in a second. But just interesting to see in the picture. You can even see it in the picture of the Karaite cemetery. There are more ancient burial caves on the side, right? All the valleys around Jerusalem have burial caves, including Gay Ben-Hinnom. So there are some ancient burial caves there. Another cemetery close to the Karaite Cemetery is a cemetery called the Sambuski Cemetery. This was a cemetery that was used up until, give or take, 100 years ago, during the time of the British Mandate. It was a cemetery, what we would call today Potter's Field, right, for people who really couldn't afford a nice grave for themselves. So this was meant for poor Sephardim, as, you know, it was run by the Sephardi Kehillah with their money, but for people who really couldn't afford anything. Eventually it stopped being used. But it was also used for something else fascinating. It was the place where you would bury things that go into Geniza, right? We know that if you have an old Sefer Torah, an old Siddur, an old Tanakh, you can't use it anymore. Of course, you don't throw it away. You put it into Geniza. But at a certain point, the Geniza is full, right? You got to bury the Geniza. You can't keep the Geniza unless you're the Cairo Geniza. You don't keep it in the shul forever. And at a certain point, every few years, the Geniza is emptied and it's actually taken to be buried. And this still happens today, by the way, but not here. And this was the Geniza for books as well as for stones from the Kotel. Right. If any stones fell out, some people might remember a few years ago, there was a stone that popped out of the Kotel, right? And they actually put it back. But sometimes this would happen. And because it has proximity to the Temple Mount, it has holiness, and they would bury it there. So this was a cemetery. And we know we have We have evidence that in the 19th century, there was actually a regular parade to bring books to the Geniza, books from the Geniza to burial. They would bring them under a chuppah, right? Very, very cool. Today, sadly, this cemetery is very abandoned and neglected, and you can see it's in terrible shape. And in recent years, there has been an effort, mostly by tour guides, but I think anybody is welcome to come, that they have a day where they come and they restore and they clean up the cemetery, and they actually do it on the 7th of Adar, which is a very appropriate date, right? Zion Adar, the date that is Moshe Rabbeinu's yahrzeit, right? The day that he died. Why Zion Adar? Because it's the date for people whose graves are not known, right? Because Moshe's grave is not known. So that's when they do this restoration of the cemetery. So that's just a neat little thing to know about. Sultan's Pool, okay? Many of us have walked over the bridge that leads from Der Chevron towards the old city. Maybe you have even gone to a concert in Sultan's Pool or to the crafts fair in Sultan's Pool. And you may have said, well, why is this a pool? Because it was a pool. Okay. In Ottoman times, Sultan Suleiman put, there was a pool here, and he put a fountain, a sabil, on the bridge. The fountain can, the structure can still be seen. And this is also a place that had, is part of the aqueduct system, bringing water from south of the city into Jerusalem. So there really was a pool here, and you can see it here. In Ottoman times, there used to be, and even in British Mandate times, there used to be an animal market here in Sultan's Pool. But today in modern Israeli Jerusalem, this has all been cleaned up, and Sultan's Pool is used as a venue for concerts and crafts fairs and film festivals and all sorts of things like that. So kind of a different thing. One last thing about Sultan's Pool. Before people really understood so much about archaeology and understood where was the city of David and where were the stories that take place in David's time, right? The idea was that David dwelt in the Tower of David, which you can see in the back of the picture over here by Jaffa Gate, which of course he did not, but that was what people thought. And when he looked out to see Bathsheba in her bath, where was she bathing? In Sultan's Pool, of course, because that's a great place to bathe, right? So that was the story about Sultan's Pool and David. Not true, Bobomysis, but still interesting. Okay. One more thing below Mount Zion. I think we might have talked about this, so we'll just look at it very quickly, right? We have walls of the city, right? Mount Zion was within the walls of the city for a very long time, okay? And in salvage excavations that were done here, we actually have a wall that goes back to Byzantine times. And below it, we have a wall that goes back to Hasmonean times. And below that, we have a wall that goes back to First Temple times. So we have the walls of the city that go towards the valley, not all the way down to the valley, but towards the valley. This is below Mount Zion, right? This is on the east side of the valley. Okay, but let's get to the west side, right? We talked about the shoulders of the Hinnom. Right on the other side of the valley. Today, you have the Menachem Begin Heritage Center, which is an amazing museum, very worth visiting. New building. Behind it, a much older building called the Scottish Church. Okay, that's from the Middle Ages. In between those two buildings, there's a complex of ancient graves. And today, the city of Jerusalem, a couple of years ago, actually made a very nice, accessible, with lots of explanatory signs, little park to showcase this place. Before, you had to walk into the Begin Center and go through the back and get their permission. Now you can actually walk in off the street. It's lovely. What is this and why is it important? So remember what we said. People bury outside the city. Okay. Jews do not bury inside the city, but they also don't go very far to bury. So you have something that's close by. And this shoulders of the Hinnom Valley, that's a good place to bury. So the fellow who's sitting here on the rock is Professor Gabi Barkai. who's a very well-known Jerusalem archaeologist. He's the guy to go to if you want to know about burial caves in Jerusalem, burial in Jerusalem in general. And he excavated here in the late 70s and the early 80s. And they found burial from Roman times, right? They found actually burial from Byzantine times, burial from Roman times, but then they found burial from First Temple times, which is very exciting, right? Now, how did they bury in First Temple times? And we talked about this a little, I think, on other classes. What they did is what we call primary and secondary burial. They laid out the bodies to be buried, and this is not a great picture. If you come, you can see it much better. You can actually see this was a cave. It was covered. The top of the cave fell in. But you can actually see kind of outlines. Think of like paper dolls, right? Cutouts of people with a place for the head. And they would lay the body out. The body would lie there until it decomposed, give or take a year. Okay. And then you would take the bones and you would put them in what's called a ma'asefa, a gathering place, right? Because what's the classic language in Tanakh when someone dies? Vayesaf el avotav. He's gathered onto his fathers. We say, oh, that's such a beautiful metaphorical phrase. It's beautiful and metaphorical, but it's also actually physically true. They actually took your bones and put them with your father's bones and your grandfather's bones and your great grandfather's bones. Everybody's bones go together. Okay. Now that's just interesting to see. But we also know that in First Temple times, people buried with stuff. And everybody's very shocked by this. What? Jews didn't do that? Yes, Jews did that, just like Egyptians did and just like Canaanites did. Everybody buried with stuff because nobody knew what there was going to be when you get to the next world. You better take some tzedala derech, right? You better have some stuff with you. Now, that should be very exciting for archaeologists, right? Because we'll find that stuff. And not so fast, right? Just like I know their stuff and the archaeologists know their stuff, grave robbers knew there was stuff long ago. And almost all of these caves have been plundered, have been robbed. We have caves in the Kidron Valley that have inscriptions that say there's nothing in here. Don't look for anything, right? Or you'll be cursed if you open these. But that didn't deter anybody. So Gabi Barkai comes and he's excavating here. And it's exciting and it's important, but he doesn't expect to find too many treasures because all these places have been plundered. And the story goes that he was hosting a group of school kids who came to dig with him. And he had one kid who was not particularly helpful. So he sent him off. He said, you go dig away, far away from me. Get out of my sight. Right? He sent him off to dig somewhere else. And the kid comes back a little while later and he's very, very excited. He's holding something in his hand. He says, can I show you something? And what do you want to show me? Well, you sent me to dig over there. And I saw that in the cave that you sent me to, in the back, there was a little hole. And I was curious. So I crawled into the hole and I fell down into a second cave. The second cave was full of stuff. It had bones, it had pottery, it had jewelry, it had everything that you could imagine because nobody had discovered it. Okay, so it was an amazing discovery. But the most exciting thing that he found was, well, they obviously then went and cleaned it out and excavated and found everything. The most exciting thing were two tiny rolled up pieces of silver, which when they were very painstakingly unrolled, you can see have writing on them. Now, if you look closely, you can see that this is the old Hebrew writing, the Ketav Ivri Atik, right? In First Temple times, they used a different script than what we use today or what they even used in Second Temple times. And once they were able to unroll it and to read it, they found that it said something very interesting. It said, Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'yasem lecha shalom. Okay, almost the entire text of the Birkat Kohanim, of the priestly blessing that we say today in Beit Knesset, right? This is a Torah text. It is the oldest Torah text that we have, although now there's just Facebook posts about an inscription that maybe is quoting Sefer Malachim, but not clear yet. Okay? But this is 500 years older than the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay, this goes back to First Temple times, and it's a text from the book of Bamidbar. And it's a very, very, very exciting thing to find. It was very exciting at the time, and it's still exciting today. why was somebody buried with a little rolled up piece of silver that had the Birkat Kohen name on it? Maybe it was a priestly family, or more likely, this was an amulet, right? You're going to a frightening place. You don't know what's going to be. You want something that's going to protect you. The Birkat Kohen name is going to protect you. I will tell the coda to the story, even if people have heard it before, just because it's such a good end to the story. After this was all cleaned up and restored and whatever, it was put in the Israel Museum. About 10 years later, Gavi Barkai was giving a tour of the museum to a group of soldiers, and he told this story. And a young man in the back raised his hand and he says, that was me. I was the kid. So that's just, it's a good story and it sounds like it's not true, but it's actually has been heard directly from Gabi Barkai's mouth. So I trust it. Okay. Another grave. And then we're going to move into the future. Okay. This is a grave that is behind the King David Hotel of today, right? If you've ever walked in that nice park behind the King David Hotel, the big, beautiful park. Why is it a big, beautiful park in this very upscale area? How come it's never been developed? Because it's owned by the Greek Orthodox Church. And green spaces in Jerusalem, unless they are deliberately set aside by the Jerusalem Foundation, they stay green because they're owned by a church. And the church doesn't particularly want to sell them or lease them. So that's the story of the park behind the King David. And in that park, tucked away in a corner of the park, is this burial cave. Now, you can see it looks different than what we saw before. And what's interesting about it is it has this stone, right? This is just the top of the stone. The stone is actually a full circle, okay? And this is called an Even Golal. Right. In Hebrew, when you want to say the conversation is over, you know, you want to tell your teenager, absolutely, this is never happening. It's called listom alav et hagolal, to close up with the closing stone. Right. This is an Even Golal. When person was buried, you rolled the stone in front of the cave and that's it. You're not getting out anymore. This was discovered in the late 19th century by the autodidact architect, archaeologist, urban planner, et cetera, Conrad Schick. He suggested that this was the family tomb of Herod because Josephus writes about Herod's family being buried outside of the city of Jerusalem. We have no proof, meaning we haven't found any inscriptions or anything to tell us that that really is what it is, but people do call it Herod's tomb. But now that we've found the tomb in Herodian, it seems less likely that this is Herod's family tomb. But so far, we don't have anybody else that we can describe it to. All right, let's move into more modern times. Okay, so in the mid to late 19th century, the population in the Old City grows enormously, particularly the Jewish population, right? Just to give you an example, Rav Shmuel Salant comes to Jerusalem in 1841 as a young man. He's a 25-year-old. He's brought to be the chief rabbi of Jerusalem for the Ashkenazi community, which numbers a few hundred. He has a very long life. By the time he dies in 1909, the Ashkenazi community is about 15,000. Okay. So it's a huge growth in a very, very short time. The other communities grow too, but nothing like the Jews. The Jewish community grows the most. This is the beginnings of Zionism. People start coming. Okay. And the Old City and the Jewish area is the smallest of all the areas. There is somewhat of an expansion into the Muslim quarter. We talked about this last time, but it's not enough space. The Jews tended not to own property. They had to lease it. And they got tiny areas for ridiculous amounts of money. Landlords completely had the upper hand, so they would have people pay a full year's rent in advance, and then they'd find someone who was willing to pay more, and they'd kick you out, right? Terrible, terrible conditions. Not only that, but because it's so crowded, it becomes very unsanitary. The Ottoman Turks who are in charge don't care at all about the Old City, so they take out the garbage exactly once a year on Erev Pesach. Hey, people empty their chamber pots out into the street. Terrible, terrible conditions, just no space. Okay? Besides the fact that Jews are not exactly treated wonderfully by the Muslims and the Christians who were in the Old City with them. So there needs to be a solution. Now, like we said, not only the Jews want to move out, okay? You have other groups who want to expand too, not necessarily because of overcrowding, but for lots of different reasons. And the Christians want to expand because they want each country wants to have a foothold in Jerusalem. And that's why in the late 19th, early 20th century, you have every one of the European powers comes and build something in Jerusalem. And that's why you have these crazy representations of so many different countries in Jerusalem, France and Germany and England. And Russia is the first one. Okay? The Russians have many, many pilgrims who come to visit Jerusalem. It's a very long and arduous journey. So they're not exactly coming for the weekend. They need to come, stay for a few months before they can go home. Where are all these people going to stay? They have nowhere to be, right? Plus, they're all crowded into that Church of the Holy Sepulchre, very, very crowded, and a few other small churches. They want to have some space. So what they do is they decide to build not one building, but a compound. And anyone who knows a little bit about Jerusalem knows right by City Hall at the end of Jaffa Road is what we call the Russian compound, which is made up of a bunch of different buildings, okay? Some of which are still in their original use, like the church, most of which are not, right? Some of them were taken over by the Jerusalem police force. One of them is now a museum, what used to be the women's hostel, which turned into the British prison, which turned into the museum of the underground prisoners, one of which has been turned into a luxury hotel, right? A lot of interesting things have happened in the Russian compound. But the Russians choose this location. If you can remember where it is, it's literally a 5-minute walk from Jaffa Gate, right? You want to be outside the old city, but you don't want to be too far outside the old city, because that's very dangerous, right? That's not a safe place. You want to be close by. Plus, you want to be able to go to all the pilgrimage sites in the old city. So that's the first pioneer, but we want to talk about the Jewish story, okay? So what do the Jews do? They begin by deciding to build something inside the walls, okay? So they take a property in the Jewish quarter right near Mount Zion, okay, and they get some money. We'll talk about from who in a minute. And they build this very beautiful building, which is still standing today. It's been restored, but it's still the original building. And it's called Batei Machaseh La'aniyim Bahar Tzion, Tivneh V'Tichonein. Okay? Batei Machaseh, shelter houses for the poor on Mount Zion. Okay. This is money that comes from a kollel, a community organization, not a kollel like we think today of people who sit and learn all day, but a kollel in 19th century means a community organization. It's called Kollel Hod. Hod, Holland ve Deutschland, right? Jews of Holland and of Germany, they give some of the money, okay? We're going to see who else gives the other money. And in 1857, they build this house, this building. Everybody gets a luxurious two-room apartment. There's a cistern for water. Ah, fabulous. What could be better? What could be better? You needed a lot more spaces. There's not enough space here. Today, by the way, this is used as the Talmud Torah for the Zilberman School in the Old City. The other money, not all the money, comes from the community organization of the Dutch and the German Jews, but it comes from a family whose shield is depicted right here. Okay, whose crest, as you can see, it is red. It's kind of a faded red, but it's a red shield. Okay, red shield, translate into German, Rothschild, Rothschild. Okay, the Rothschilds are, of course, one of the two addresses if you are a Jew looking for money. The other one, Moses Montefiore, we're going to come to in a minute, right? Not all of the Rothschilds are interested in helping the Jews and are definitely not interested in Zionism. Most of them are either very assimilated or convert to Christianity, but there are some who are interested in Jews and in the land of Israel. Okay. And they get money from the Rothschilds to build this. What's interesting about the crest, by the way, it's a red shield, very nice. But you can also see that there are five arrows that are tied together. And the story goes that the patriarch of the family, Amschel Rothschild in Frankfurt, had five sons. And he called them together and he took out an arrow and he showed them, here, look how easily I can break this arrow, snaps it in half. He takes five arrows, he ties them together and he says to one of his sons, see if you can break it. Of course, they can't break it. And he says, if you stay together, your power will be unbreakable. But if you split apart, you won't be able to make it. So that's our Rothschild shield, Rothschild crest. But this is not enough room. And the understanding is that we have to move outside the walls. Now, this is a very drastic solution and nobody wants to do it. Okay. Why? Because it's scary outside the walls. Okay. There's wild animals. There's bandits. There's a reason there's a wall around the city. It's meant to protect you. So along comes the hero of our story. We're going to hear more about him in 1 minute. And that is Sir Moses Montefiore. And he says, okay, I understand all your issues and all your problems, but I'm going to help you solve them. So what does he do? What he does is he buys a piece of land. Okay. And he builds a neighborhood. First of all, it has a wall around it. And even today, when you walk through beautiful Mishkenot Sha'ananim and it's peaceful and it's lovely and it's expensive, the wall is still there, right? The wall still exists. The gate still exists. So it's meant to be a little bit of a copy, a mini old city. And even the way he designs the buildings with the crenellations, right, with these designs on the top, it's meant to look like the old city. So it's walled. It's protected. Okay. He gives it a great name. He calls it Mishkenot Sha'ananim, peaceful dwellings. Oh, don't worry. Everything here is just fine. Right. You'll be so safe. Not to mention that one of the major news items in the 1870s was a Jew who was murdered as he was leaving the old city and going across Gay Ben Hinnom to come back to Mishkenot Sha'ananim. These were not fears that were unfounded. They were definitely founded. But the idea was, this is peaceful, it's safe, it's secure, and there was a special, contract that you had to sign in order to be accepted into the neighborhood. There were very strict rules about security and about sanitation, because those are the two things people are concerned about. Sanitation, because the old city doesn't have it. Security, because we're not inside the wall. So you couldn't bring in outside guests without permission. You had to make sure that your garbage was taken out and your floors were clean, et cetera, et cetera. So Moses Montefiore builds this neighborhood. He puts a windmill in it. Why? Not to be picturesque, but because this is a way for people to make a living. Okay. You're going to grind wheat into flour. The irony is that it's never used because by the time he brings in the fancy imported equipment from England to make the best possible windmill, steam powered mills had come to the land of Israel. And this is antiquated. This is archaic. It's never used. There's a famous poem by Yehuda Amichai where he talks about the windmill has ground dreams and visions, but it's never ground flour, right? But Montefiore builds these houses and everyone gets this very nice, fabulous little apartment. And not only that, but he gave people free housing, right? Way to make a living, synagogue, and even a stipend to live here. But people are not very quick to sign up because they're nervous, because they're worried. And even the few people who sign up, many of them sneak back into the old city to sleep there at night because they don't want to be out here. But what happens? We have a terrible cholera epidemic a few years after this is built. And cholera, of course, is spread by dirty water, garbage, poor hygiene. And the people in the old city universally get sick. Those few brave souls who've moved out don't. And people say, maybe not so crazy. And they start to move in. Now, this area has all been restored because, like we said, between 48 and 67 on the border, not so safe. Today, this one of the original buildings is a writer's residence. People want to come to write in Jerusalem and they get, a scholarship to come and do that for a year. This is where they stay. I just want you to notice above the rooms are the original designations. That was not apartment number one, apartment number two. It was Hebrew letters, right? So you can still see that today, which is kind of neat. The money, like we said, comes if you either ask the Rothschilds or you ask Montefiore, right? So Montefiore, we have Moses. We usually have, I actually had in the older version that I had of this PowerPoint, I had a picture of him as an old man. And usually you see pictures of him as an old man. He actually lived to a very old age. He lived to be 101. And I said, poor Montefiore, let's put a picture of him as a young man. So here he is as a young man. I wouldn't say he's like going to win any beauty contest, but okay, at least he's young. His wife, on the other hand, is very pretty, Judith. They very interesting couple. They were both very very involved in helping the Jewish community. She comes from a moneyed Ashkenazi family in England. Her sister is married to a Rothschild. He comes actually from not such a wealthy family of Sephardim from Italy, who moved to London, but he builds himself up and then marries into this family, and his brother-in-law is a Rothschild, and they do business together, and he does very well for himself. He does so well for himself that he can retire in middle age and basically help Jews, right? That's pretty much what he does. And he travels to the land of Israel. They traveled to the land of Israel 7 times. He has many attempts to help the Jews of Jerusalem. Mostly they spurn him because they're all so quarrelsome and they can't agree on anything. But they do a lot to try and help the Jews of Jerusalem. They never had children. They were unable to have children. And that's why the 5 neighborhoods in Jerusalem that are named after him are a very important memorial. By the way, their marriage was very scandalous at the time because she was Ashkenaz and he was Sephardi, right? And that was not done, but he proved himself. He was a worthy husband, and it kind of broke down some barriers. They had so much money that, A, he was knighted, and he actually became remember if it was the Lord Mayor or the sheriff of London, I think. And this is a Jew in the 19th century. This is very unusual. They build themselves a fabulous estate in a place called Ramsgate. Their next door neighbor would come and play in their garden. A nice little girl whose name was Victoria. She would play in their garden. She becomes, of course, Queen Victoria. Okay. So he's very, very well connected, but very involved in helping the Jews, and very much a proud Jew at a time that it wasn't so easy to be a proud Jew. And this is, you can see this from his family crest. Okay, obviously he's knighted. He becomes Sir Moses Montefiore. He has to have a family crest. But what is his family crest? He's got the Lion of Judah. He's got Hatzvi Israel, right? The deer is also a symbol of the Jews. He's got banners that say Jerusalem. So he's very much a proud Jew, and he becomes very much kind of this figure of folklore almost. And anyone who knows a little bit Hebrew songs knows this song, which is sounds much better in Hebrew, right? Hasar Moshe Montefiore, right? Behu ala la merkava. It's all about how this is a song by Chaim Hefer, famously sung by Yehoram Gaon. And basically, it's about how every time the angel of death would come to collect Moses Montefiore, he would say, oh, no, 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 I got a lot to do. I got to help the Jews in Russia. I've got to help the Jews in Damascus. I have to help the Jews in Jerusalem. It's not time yet, right? But finally, they translate it here as the sir, right? In Hebrew, it's hasar. Hasar, like the officer or the dignitary. When he turned 100 in another year, the angels granted him the very last kiss, and he slowly closed his eyes, asking only a Jerusalem stone to be put under his head. But still to this day, when the night falls, there are those who are ready to swear that they saw him wandering next to his carriage, right? So in Jerusalem, in the beautiful restored Mishkenot Sha'ananim, you can go and you can see Sir Moses Montefiore's beautiful carriage, which he traveled in. Now, realize traveling in the 19th century was not so easy, right? Not none of the luxuries that we have today. And when Sir Moses and Lady Judith would travel, he would bring with him, he kept mitzvot. He wasn't so careful when he was young, but he became a Shomer Shabbat, Shomer Kashrut Jew as he grew older. And he brought with him a shochet, a ritual slaughterer, so that he always would have kosher meat. He brought with him his own dishes, and he had this special outfitted carriage that he would travel in. And this was on display in Jerusalem for a long time, until in the 1980s, there was vandals who broke into the display case and destroyed it. And this is what's there today is a reconstruction of the famous carriage. A little sad, but still nice to know about. And that's Sir Moses Montefiore. But not all the money came from him. Less well known than Montefiore, although somewhat well known by American Jews, was another wealthy Jew whose name was Judah Turo. Judah Turo, who dies before Montefiore. He was older than Montefiore, right? Montefiore lives from 1784 to 1885. Judah Turo was born in 1775, right? 9 years earlier, but he dies already by 1854. Okay. 30 years before Moses Montefiore. He wants to give money to the Jews of Jerusalem, but they are such a fractious bunch. He doesn't want to give them the money directly. Nobody's going to use it properly. So what do rich people do? They give their money to other rich people. So he calls up Sir Moses and he says, listen, I'm giving you $50,000. $50,000 in the 19th century, quite a lot of money. I want you to use it to help the Jerusalem Jews. And he gives it to him. And with that money and with Montefiore's own money, they build the neighborhood of Mishkenot Sha'ananim. And that's why when you go into Mishkenot Sha'ananim, the dedication sign, which was harmed in the battles between 48 and 67, but you can still see it mostly, right? Mishkenot Sha'ananim is nityasdu me'eit trumot ha'kesef, right? This is given from the donations. Asher he'niach acharav ha'gvir Yehuda Turo. Okay, that he left behind him, the Gvir, right? The wealthy, important man, Yehuda Turo, Nishmato Eden, Mikehal Kadosh, New Orleans. Okay, New Orleans, Bimidinat America. That one, that part is hard to read. Alpi Hasar Moshe Montefiore, and it tells you the date, 1860. His ring and the deed of land were put into the foundation of the building. So Judah Turo is also involved. If you've ever wandered around Mishkenot Sha'ananim and you've seen a street sign that says T-U-R-A Street, Tura Street, it is a sad misspelling of Judah Turo, who we should be proud of and we should spell his name right, but what can we do? We don't. All right. Moses Montefiore goes on and gives more money, both in his lifetime and after his death. If we had more time, I would quiz you on what are the five different names of the Moshe neighborhoods. In fact, you can put them in the chat and we can look at the end if you know any Moshe neighborhoods. There are five distinct neighborhoods named after Moshe Montefiore. And this is dedication signs to his neighborhoods in the area of Nachla. But just one last little bit about him. There was more land. This is a place called Kerem. You can see Kerem Moshe Montefiore v'Yehudit. Okay. There was land by Mishkenot Sha'ananim. It was meant to be built as housing for the poor. It ended up in the hands of Montefiore's nephew because, as we said, he didn't have children. The nephew misuses it. Squatters come, they move in, they get thrown out, and a new neighborhood is built there in 1893, which is called Yamin Moshe. So I gave you one of the names, right? And that's what we today call that area, Yamin Moshe, but really it's two different neighborhoods. And Montefiore is remembered in many different places, including on old banknotes of Israel. But I'll look at the end. Okay, so let's go more into modern times. So this was a neighborhood that was the first one outside the walls, but many more are built soon afterwards. It's not a particularly prestigious neighborhood up until 1948. In 1948, it is on the border. So first of all, in the battles of 1948, it's a very famous picture, the windmill, the top of the windmill is blown off. You can see it today because it's been restored. Okay. After the war, this is on the border. And if you look at this picture here on the right, this is a great picture. You can see the walls of the old city in the distance, right? And you can see the wall and the sandbags and the snipers set up in the area of Mishkenot Sha'ananim, protecting against any attacks that might have come from the old city with Gei Ben Hinnom as no man's land in the middle. So this was not a desirable neighborhood. It was on the border. What happened in 1950s Israel with non-desirable neighborhoods? Who gets stuck there? New immigrants usually, poor people, often those are one and the same. And whoever doesn't have a lot of choices, the government says, you're moving here, you're moving here. Okay, you say, great. They survived those 19 difficult years. 1967, the city is reunited. They're sitting on a gold mine, right? Not so right. Basically, Teddy Kollek and the municipality of Jerusalem decide that this area is going to be turned into a beautiful place for beautiful people. They want it to be an artist colony, and they have to get rid of the less beautiful people. And that's what they do. And they say, oh, we've built you new, beautiful shikunim, new, beautiful apartment buildings in the Katamonim. And actually, this is the very first time. They don't win, but it's historic because it's the first time that it's done that in socialist Israel, socialist paternalistic Israel, people actually stood up and said, we're not going. And they protested. And they protested. They said, "We're not leaving." And in the end, they were forced out. But they did protest, and it led the way to people not being forced out of other neighborhoods like Musrara, for example, when that was gentrified and that was beautified. Okay, we're going to move on from Mishkin Ochanan Anim in our last time that we have. Let's talk a little about the train. Okay, so the train comes to Jerusalem in 1892. This was another idea that originally was Montefiore's idea. It's not successful. He doesn't manage to pull it off. It's complicated till they can get the investors, till they can get the backing, the approvals, et cetera, et cetera. But eventually it's built. It's not built particularly well, and anyone who's an old timer in Israel may remember the train, right? And the jokes about the train. You know, people would the famous joke of, you know, a guy walking alongside the train tracks, and the conductor leans out of the train and he says, "You want a ride?" And the guy says, "Oh, no, thank you, not today. I'm in a hurry," right? Because the train was just ridiculously, ridiculously slow. And it stopped being used about 20 years ago, and today we have the new train, right? It had many stages. But when this train is built, this is a very big thing. It means it heralds a new era in Jerusalem, because instead of a 16-hour, 2-day journey by wagon, donkeys, and camels from Jaffa to Jerusalem, you could load things onto the train from the port in Jaffa and ship them to Jerusalem in 4 hours. So this is a very, very big deal, and it's celebrated with a lot of ceremony, and it opens up neighborhoods in the south of Jerusalem because people want to be near the train. So it is an important milestone in the history of Jerusalem. Not far from the train is a very iconic building, which today is somewhat obscured by its across the street neighbor, the King David, but this is actually a very important building, and that's the YMCA. Just like the European powers want to build in Jerusalem, the Americans, they come a little later, but they also want to build in Jerusalem. And in 1926, they decide to build a classically American building, a YMCA, right? A Young Men's Christian Association. The idea of the building, both in form and in function, and it's still true today, is to connect between the religions, right? And today there's a day camp for Christian and Muslim and Jewish kids, and there's a sports center that's used by everybody, and it's meant to be kind of this island of coexistence. In the beginning, the Jews of Jerusalem objected because they said it's going to be a missionizing place. It's really not a missionizing place. And even the architecture of the building is meant to showcase themes from the three religions. So first of all, strange as it might sound, the skyscraper of Jerusalem was designed by the exact same architect as the skyscraper or one of the skyscrapers of New York, the Empire State Building, okay? Arthur Loomis Harmon, American architect, and he comes to Jerusalem and he designs the YMCA. YMCA is slightly shorter. It's only 6 stories high, but it's a skyscraper in Jerusalem. And it has many, this is the architectural historian David Kreuenker calls the YMCA a sermon in stone, because it has all this iconography, all these symbolic things, right? Three buildings, you have the Trinity, you have the Shema on one building, you have the Muslim call to prayer on one building, you have many, many Christian images, right? Jesus is the Lamb of God, you have the Gospels, you have 12 trees in the garden that are meant to represent the 12 tribes or the disciples of Jesus. You have many, many, many things. Verses that are on the walls. It's really a fascinating building. Inside, it's also very, very beautiful with designs that are like these Damascus ceilings and very, very rich. The rooms are not so fancy, but the public spaces are very beautiful. And if you live in Jerusalem, you may have done this. You can venture up into the tower, which doesn't seem so high, but once you get to the top, you actually have an amazing view everywhere. And right before you get to the top, there is a whole set of bells because the YMCA has a carillon and they do bell concerts, which is really cool, right? So this is the time of the year for the YMCA. They do Christmas concerts. They do all this kind of stuff. But 5 years after the YMCA is built with its unparalleled, unbroken view of the old city, the King David goes up across the street and completely destroys their view. Not very nice. Okay? The King David becomes the Hotel of Jerusalem, built in 1931. It's the place where anybody who's anybody is going to stay. It's meant to look like an Eastern palace, okay? And it becomes the most important place where anybody who's a dignitary is going to come to. If you've been inside the King David, you may have seen what they did for their, I think it was their 75th anniversary. They made like a fake sort of like a red carpet with the signatures from their guest book of all sorts of famous people. So they've really had all sorts of important people staying there. But what the King David is most famous for is not something to do with the King David, but rather with the Irgun. July 22nd, 1946, because the King David was part of British headquarters in Jerusalem, there were explosives that were smuggled in milk cans. The Menachem Begin, to the end of his days, swore that he telephoned the British with a warning to evacuate the building, and they ignored the warning. And an entire wing of the building was blown up, and 91 people were killed, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. Why did they want, this was an operation that originally the Haganah was involved in, and then they pulled out, and only the Irgun did, but why were they so interested in doing this? It wasn't only to terrify the British, but there were documents that had been taken from the Jewish agency 3 weeks earlier that implicated many Haganah members, and the desire was to get rid of these documents. So it actually was to help the Haganah, but they in the end didn't do it. The Irgun did, and this was something that was one of those last straws that that led to the British needing to get out of the land of Israel. But this was a very, very important thing. And if you ever walk by the King David today, you will notice that one of the wings has been completely rebuilt. Okay, and our final thing that we're going to look at. Remember we said that the Hinnom Valley between 48 and 67 was no man's land. Okay. How could you get from the west side, which was under Israeli control, to the Mount Zion, which was also under Israeli control, by going through no man's land? So you needed to get supplies. You needed to figure out what to do. So this gentleman here with the glasses, his name is Uriel Chefetz. He was a hero in 1948. He was a hero again in the Yom Kippur War, evacuating civilians in his private car. He was really an extraordinary guy. He was wounded very terribly trying to help people in the Ma'alot terror attack, and he died of his wounds. He was an extraordinary guy, but he was an engineer. And he designed a very small and clandestine cable car that stretched out over the valley, a 200-meter cable. At night, it was kind of, the cable was slackened and put down into the valley so that nobody could see it. And during the day, you could ferry supplies and, not very comfortably, a couple of people across. It was only used for about 6 months because it was very, very impractical. And they really didn't need it in the end. They didn't have to smuggle supplies across. And then it was put down into the valley and kind of not forgotten about, but nobody really talked about it. And only in 1972 did they create a museum for it, which still exists today. It's right next to the Mount Zion Hotel. And you can see the little cable car has been put back up and pictures about the whole story. And it's actually a very interesting story. And he, in fact, built not one, but two cable cars. If you go up north to Ein Gev on the eastern side of the Kinneret, so above Ein Gev was is a mountain called Susita, which had an Israeli outpost on top, and he built a cable car that went from the kibbutz to the mountain as well. So he was a very interesting guy. All right, let's see what questions people have, and then I have to announce our – should I announce the trip first? I'm announcing the trip first, okay? I'm going to put it in the chat now again. If you are in Israel or you want to be coming to Israel, we will be doing a first ever Torah in Motion trip to two different days, Wednesday, the 28th of December, Thursday, the 29th of December, Wednesday in Jerusalem, Thursday in Gush Etzion and Beit Guvrin. It is going to be a really, really nice trip, and I am going to guide it, and I would love if anyone could come. And Rabbi Kelman says that the prices are going up on Monday. So early bird discount. Sign up. All right. Let's see what questions we have. No, private. Shlomo Artzi mentions Beit Guvrin in one of his songs. Yes, it is a, it was a military, it was important in the 1948. I don't remember the reference exactly. Who owned the property in the Jewish quarter? Usually Arab landowners, right? Arab landowners own the property.
Yes, good afternoon. Quarter. Could you connect me with the eyeglasses?
Whoever is talking, can you mute yourself? Whoever you are. I don't see who you are. I'll just mute everybody. You can unmute yourselves when you want to.
Lisa Sandro, please unmute yourself.
I tried to mute. Okay. There's a song about Moses Montefiore. Yes, we brought that in. Yoram Gaon. Montefiore was the executor of Turo's will. Correct. Which donor was known as Hanadiva Yadua? That's Rothschild, Edmund de Rothschild. He's the guy who gave money for Zichron Yaakov and Rishon LeZion and the winery, et cetera, et cetera. The Montefiore census. I don't know anything about that. I will look it up. Never heard of that. Whoever said that can write about it. If can talk about it, you can unmute yourselves. Young Rome, Ram Gaon, yes. Kiryat, okay. So now we're getting the answers to my question. Kiryat Moshe, you mean Moshe. Very nice. That's two. Kiryat Moshe, Mazkeret Moshe. Oh, Moshe, Zichron, oh, very nice. You got them all. Good for you, everybody. Oh, Moshe, Zichron Moshe, Mazkeret Moshe, Kiryat Moshe, you mean Moshe. Okay. Mamila is also very interesting. Mamila is a different thing. Old joke was that the YMCA was the tallest building. Who can forget Paul Newman? It's true. Who can forget Paul Newman? No one. Okay. The Montefiore song. I will see if I can find it. Anyway, I'm going to unmute you all. Oh, I didn't allow you to unmute yourself. You can unmute yourself if you have anything else you want to add. Does anyone want to add anything? I will look for the Montefiore song census. Meanwhile.
The Montefiore census was done because before he went, before he came, they would do a census in order for him to give out money to people.
Ah, very nice.
So they had it. And the original copy, the original pages exist. That's the link I sent. So he did it in 1839, 1840, 49, 55, 66, and 75. And you can look at who was living there and the different kollelim that existed all over Israel.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you. That's a very, very interesting thing. Thank you so much. Oh, here's the YouTube, and I posted the lyrics. Okay. So, thank you.
In the old city, they only started digging up and modernizing the infrastructure and the plumbing in 1771. We were living there then. And also, at that time, there were still a few stores and people living on Mamila. Mamila was one of the reasons why you see all the numbers is because it was they had beautiful buildings with unbelievable windows. We used to shop in the middle of Mamila at Levi's Makolet when we couldn't make it up to Supersol.
That's very cool. All right. I love the living history. Very nice. Anyone else have anything they want to add?
Yeah, Shuli, my father, years and years and years ago, after the King David was built, he would still take a room in the YMCA across the street on the highest floor so that he could have the old city at the YMCA cheap rate. And so he always took a room in the YMCA.
Very smart.
Yeah.
But so you have to go. It used to be 5 shekel to go to the top. Now it's something like 20 shekel, which is disgusting, but it's still cool.
But then he would go to have breakfast in the King David because that was the big
very smart man. All right. Thank you, everybody. Next week is Hanukkah, but we have a class unless I hear otherwise. So it is our last class.
Chag Sameach. Toda rabah.
Chag Sameach. Thank you, everyone. Shabbat Shalom and Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.
Thank you.